Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrey, and today we're talking about Witch Week by Diana Wynne Jones. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hi, Adam.
Hello, hello.
So I chose this book because it's one that I read over and over again as a kid. Although, strangely, I never read any of the others in the series. Because it's part of a series by Diana Wynne Jones of Crestomancy novels, which are all related to this character of Crestomancy, who's an enchanter who has nine lives. Crestomancy is a title, so there are various Crestomancies, but in one of the other books, The Lives of Christopher Chant, we follow Christopher as he becomes the Crestomancy. And Crestomancy does turn up in this book, but it's quite a fleeting appearance, only towards the end. And otherwise, it pretty much stands alone. So
yeah, I was able to follow it and comprehend it. I don't know if I would have known, apart perhaps from, you know, I might have thought, oh, this Crestomancy figure's just kind of popped up out of nowhere, somewhat inexplicably. But
yes.
I think if it weren't, you know, apart from that, I wouldn't have known it was part of a series.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember being a little bit confused about who this guy was who turns up towards the end and sort of feeling like I should know who he is, but you can read it as a standalone.
So do you know how you came to the book? Like, did you get it from the library? Was it bought for you?
I don't know. I owned it because I still... the copy I've been reading is the copy that I had as a kid. But I don't know where I got it from.
It found its way into your possession.
Yeah. The interesting thing that I found in looking at this copy is that all the quotes on the back are talking about how funny it is. They're like, very funny, highly entertaining, compulsive, exhilarating, and often hilarious. And it is funny.
Yeah, in places.
Yeah, but I remember it as being unsettling. mostly that's the lingering feeling I had about it, is that the setting of the school and the kind of miserable chilliness of this boarding school that it's set in.
I think I would have found it quite distressing as a child. Like, I found it tense, certainly, reading it now. I think as a child, I would have found it quite upsetting because of this sort of constant undercurrent of the characters who are witches or believe themselves to be witches are going to get found out and then summarily burnt in a big bonfire.
Yes.
So this is not a world which treats witchcraft with the respect that it is due.
No, so our protagonists are Class 2Y at Larwood House, which is a boarding school that we learn is known for having a number of witch orphans among the students. And witch orphans are a phenomenon of this version of late 20th century Britain, in which witches exist, but magic is so fiercely outlawed that witches are burnt at the stake. In fact, they've only just recently stopped burning witches at the stake in public, and now they do it in prisons. But yeah, And
I guess it's sort of like the shift in capital punishment.
Yeah.
Right. In England, which obviously existed up till the 60s, right? So that it used to be that you were put on display as a spectacle, outside Newgate or whatever, and strung up until you died. And then they far more respectably did it behind closed doors.
Yes. The story starts with the class teacher finding an anonymous note that says someone in this class is a witch. And that is the inciting incident for the book, is someone's accused of being a witch. Who is it? Is it only one person who's a witch? As it turns out, it's not.
It's sort of like Agatha Christie's "And Then There Were None." You know, everyone's implicated, but in a nice way, sort of.
Oh, sort of like Murder on the Orient Express. Everyone killed him. Yeah. It turns out that right at the end, that actually nearly everyone in the class is a witch. Nearly everyone in the world has some degree of witchcraft, but it's so thoroughly taboo that no one knows.
We could perhaps make a link with queerness. not that we tend to do that,
right? No. Why would we do such a thing? Yeah. So our main characters, at least to start with, our two main characters are Nan Pilgrim and Charles Morgan, who are the two class misfits, who are only surpassed in unpopularity by Brian Wentworth. And in the first chapter, the students are writing their mandatory journals, and we sort of learn about the world's attitude to witches through Charles. He writes his journal in code, as it's widely believed that the headmistress reads them all, which it turns out she does. And he has code words for both of the witch encounters he has. And the first one of which is actually glimpsing someone being burned on a bonfire, as public burnings were still legal when he was a child. And the second memory is of him helping a witch escape through his house. When he was a child as well. So it's sort of through Charles that we start to sort of learn what kind of world this is. Sort of, it's maybe not dissimilar to House of Stairs in that we kind of find out the details of this world through the microcosm of this school and these teenage characters.
Yeah, and also, like House of Stairs, the characters are a bit of a rum lot, albeit perhaps not quite so bad as... Charles reminded me quite a lot of Mark Corrigan from Peep Show.
Yeah.
He's sort of huffily indignant and spends a lot of time thinking about how much he hates everyone.
Yeah, they're not the most... they're quite realistically teenage. I was about to say prickly. I think Diana Wynne Jones often has quite prickly protagonists.
Ah, okay. So this is the only Diana Wynne Jones I've read.
Yeah, I've read a few. She's definitely not very sentimental.
Yeah, I mean, I read a review of this on Goodreads, and it was compared to Harry Potter, and posited that it might have been an influence on Harry Potter, in as much as obviously it's a school, well, not a school for witches in this case, but a school with witches. And, you know, it's a class, and there's magic, but it also just plays through the kind of class rivalries and bullying that you'd get in a school. But they pointed out that compared to Harry Potter, you know, the characters aren't necessarily the most likeable. They said that it was a much sort of more sort of gloomy and downbeat kind of read than Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. It's tonally a lot different.
I mean, I've never read Harry Potter, I wouldn't know.
Yes, of course. I mean, I read quite a lot of boarding school stories as a kid. And I think I was never quite convinced by ones that made it sound like it was all glorious larks. Like, I think this book kind of struck me as more realistic as a kind of horrible idea of never being able to escape school or your classmates.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I have to admit, I'm very thankful I didn't go to boarding school because, yeah. Like, yeah, it doesn't even really bear thinking about.
I know, right. I think I actually shuddered when I realised, you know, they're all sleeping in dormitories. Like, oh my God, can you imagine?
Like, I think that it does do a very good job at bringing or reminding you, I guess as an adult reader, of quite how awful a lot of school is. Like, do we do this to millions of children? Like, what are we doing? Jeez.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of monsters are we? You're forcing kids into this environment where, yeah, they may well be made to feel thoroughly miserable. And I like the fact that the teachers are all, they're so kind of caught up in their own personal lives that, you know, they barely think about the kids. When they do, it's, you know, only like, oh yeah, I better be nice to this kid because that will look good for the headmaster.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Diana Wynne Jones is pretty good at sort of capturing kind of loneliness and awfulness and misery that you sometimes have being a kid. Just
that feeling of there being no respite, right? And that feeling, especially if you're getting bullied, that you kind of know that the adults will be ineffectual. And indeed, I mean, like, you know, when I was... So I laugh, but when, you know, I was bullied a lot at school. And I remember my mum eventually came in around year 9 to talk to my form teacher about it. And according to my mum, and she's a trustworthy person, my form teacher, who was a pretty odd individual. His response to my mum telling him about all this, was to look at my grades and say, well, looking at Adam's grades, it seems that Adam's good at RE. And I always say, if you're good at RE, you got nothing to worry about. So I don't know if he expected me to make the sign of the cross at my persecutors or what.
That's so bizarre.
And I remember that there was one kid who would sort of regularly, like, punch me on the arm, and, you know, would punch me on the arm in the same place, you know, where it was bruised. And his response was to pair me up with this kid in form time to try to, you know, so that hopefully together we'd make friends. And of course, all that happened was this gave him more access to punching me.
Yeah.
And it just felt like I was being punished for the fact that I was being bullied, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I think the book gets across a good sense of this sort of, that wanton unfairness you feel as a child, right?
Yeah.
That, like, adults will make these decisions. Like, you know, I was in a particularly disruptive form group, and so I often suffered class detentions, and I hated class detentions because I was very, you know, I took a lot of pride in the fact that I never otherwise got a detention at school. But I suddenly had a fair few class detentions in which I felt I was being, you know, damned by association, basically. Yeah. And yeah, I always really resented these, like the fact that I should lose my lunchtime because, you know, the people in the form who generally were the ones who bullied me were acting up, and thus I would end up being punished. Like,
yeah.
So I could see how you might end up like Childs, you know, being like a sort of huffy Mark Corrigan, just sort of resenting everyone.
Yeah.
You know, fair enough.
And yeah, Nan Pilgrim has her own problems as well, because well, she's kind of chubby and awkward and anyway, but then the headmistress sort of accidentally revealed to the school that her given name is Dulcinea, and that she's is the name of the arch witch who attempted to lead a historical witch rebellion. To be called Dulcinea in this world is pretty scandalous.
Well, they made a comparison. It's like if you're called Guy Fawkes.
Yeah.
Or I guess, I don't know, Charles Manson.
Yeah. It's a pretty outrageous thing to be called in this world that's so opposed to witchcraft. And it turns out she is named for the Archwitch, who is a descendant of hers. But this means that everyone immediately believes that Nan is the witch of 2Y.
And we get access to how these different kids feel about this through their, well, diary entries, but basically they have to keep a journal within class, which, as you said, they know the headmistress will read, but they still do record their kind of personal feelings to some extent. So you get a sense of Nan's unhappiness, partly through having access to her thoughts, but partly also because we get to see her journal entries.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, before we move too far away from this, did you ever have detention as a kid? Like, did you ever do anything to be put in detention? Yeah, strictly off the record, Ren.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I've heard about your antics as a child, putting a chicken on a train.
I definitely did antics, but I don't think they were ever quite antics enough to me to get in proper trouble.
Yeah.
Because, like, I definitely sort of tried to bend the rules, like I always tried to have lunch in places we weren't meant to be having lunch, like up various corridors and stairwells and things. So, because it was just like apart from everyone else, and you could just sit like with a group of friends and have lunch.
Yeah. So situationist reclaiming of
And like, you know, if the head of year found us, then she'd tell us to go away, but it was never quite bad enough.
So you were sort of a member of an eccentric gang, right? Of a sort, or a friendship group. Did you have a name for yourselves? I can't remember.
We were called the Chicken Gang.
And this is because of the chicken on the train? Or the underground?
Yeah.
I'm just setting you up to have to explain that.
Okay, so we had a we decided to have a day of kind of absurdist activity in central London, in which we did various silly things like dressing up in cardboard and taking vegetables for walks on a string and stuff, things like that. But and then on that same day, we happened to be on the tube and just sitting sort of nonchalantly on the back of the tube seats, there was a unwrapped frozen supermarket chicken. I think we were actually already called the Chicken Gang.
Oh,
I think
but this only solidified.
This only solidified the association. And so we sat opposite this, and then when everyone came and sat down in front of this chicken, and so we gleefully tell them that there was a chicken behind them, and they look suspicious. They'd be like, and then turn around and be like, oh, oh no.
Oh, you rascals.
Yes. We're cutting this out, right?
No, this is important information.
Oh, God. Okay.
I mean, you don't get much. You get a sense that there aren't really any friendships at this school. And it's only really through the... it's interesting that through the kind of suspicions and everyone trying to work out who's a witch, and then once they think someone's a witch, wanting them to do spells and such, that they actually start forming real friendships.
Mm.
That at the start of the book, everyone's very isolated and alone. You know, there are kind of some of the popular kids like Simon have, you know, hangers on, but they don't seem to be like real friends. And it's only really... as the book goes on, you start to get kind of solidarity between some of the different characters, and they do, by the end of the book, they seem to be much closer.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I liked the arc around Estelle, who's she's introduced very dismissively as a kind of wannabe popular girl, like. Teresa's sort of the perfect model student, and Estelle is sort of described as just a sort of hanger on and a kind of described as being quite airheaded.
Yeah, or not self-willed. She's definitely.
Yeah. But actually, over the course of the story, we find out that she was involved in the underground witch resistance through her mother, but then when that was broken up by the Inquisitors, she was sent away to this school, and she when later in the book Nan finds out that she can ride a broomstick, and she goes out, this broomstick sort of demands to be ridden, so she goes out of the dormitory at night. And when she comes back and she's totally soaked, Estelle's the one who's changed the sheets on her bed and helps her sort of hide the evidence. And then when the Inquisitor is going to come to the school, which we'll get to, but Estelle and Nan run away together. And it turns out that Estelle's actually quite kind and brave and and she's still a kind of girly character. Like, she doesn't become less kind of, you know, feminine to prove that she's actually an interesting character.
But no, she's not like a tomboy character.
Mm. But yeah, she's shown to have these qualities that aren't there, aren't apparently there at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I guess an advantage of having so... as listeners may have already got the impression of, there aren't really protagonists in this book.
Mm.
I mean, it sort of focuses on Charles and Nan, but really, it's the whole class. So, a disadvantage is sometimes it feels like this is an odd smorgasbord. You know, we're like cross-cutting between these different characters, and sometimes it feels like it's in danger of losing focus. Although, I think mostly there's enough incident and... funny bits that doesn't really happen, but an advantage is that I think we do get a good sense of all of these kids, and we do get the sense of the class as a unit and how the school works, so you get a sense of the interactions and the kind of rhythms of the school, and I think I did feel like don't say part of the class, but you know, I felt like I knew the class as a whole by the end of the book.
Yeah.
Which isn't something that I think I've always found reading like young adult fiction. So that you know, normally you are faced more with individuals, whereas this works slightly differently. So that was interesting.
Mm. And different characters sort of become more prominent as the book goes on, like Estelle and Nirupam Singh as well. Who are sort of, they both kind of reveal themselves to be allies when Nana's being so thoroughly accused of witchcraft by everyone. And yeah, they sort of become, yeah, much more integral to the plot as it goes on.
Actually, yeah, in that way it reminds me of a film roughly contemporary with Witch Week, which is The Breakfast Club. Inasmuch as The Breakfast Club obviously sets you up with a bunch of students who are defined variably as, you know, the jock, the weird one. And then it kind of tests those stereotypes, and then by the end of it you have a fuller sense of who these kids are. And that they have a fuller sense of their own identities and of each other's identities.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison, yeah.
Oh, thank you. You know, I wasn't sure, so I threw it out. So
And I think, like, similarly, as you're saying, they're all quite suspicious of each other to begin with, but and they're not, like, necessarily all the best of friends by the end. Like, Brian is doesn't really have a redemptive arc at all.
So Brian is the son of the is it the head teacher or
The deputy head teacher.
The deputy head teacher. And so he's also quite intelligent, but he's not particularly agreeable. So he doesn't have very much that's charming about him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he'd get picked on anyway, as the son of a teacher. But yeah, so he gets a pretty bad deal of things. But you don't get the sense that Diana Wynne Jones particularly likes him either.
Yeah.
Like, she's obviously quite fond of Charles and Nan, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Like, you get a sense that she can kind of relate to them, whereas I don't think she really likes Brian.
No, I think because at one point, I think it's possibly Nirupan, it's like, oh, I always thought that, you know, Brian's disagreeableness was because he gets picked on so much, but actually I think he might just be a nasty person.
And he has I think there was a slight tone of like nerd alert to it, because there's a whole thing of him charting like train journeys in his head.
Oh yeah.
Then when he's meant to be doing his activities, he's actually like imagining train journeys. And I felt this was not meant to be a charm point.
Yeah, I thought that was quite cool, but...
You were like, hey, Brian, you're cooler than I thought.
I thought that was quite an interesting thing to do with this.
You and me both, bae.
But maybe I'm a nerd.
Oh, well, I think we're both kind of nerds.
So Brian is also responsible for the kind of the thing that accelerates the plot towards the end of the book, where, because he's having such a horrible time, and he decides to run away from the school, and he gets the idea that he's going to blame the witch, who by this time various magic has been happening in the school, so there's definitely known that there's at least one witch about. So Brian decides that he's going to place the blame on the witch, run away and claim that he was put under the spell of the witch. So he like writes a big screed in his journal about how he's being possessed, or he's been subject to the evil eye, and then runs away. And
and he keeps giving himself a lazy eye.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he seems to be able to make himself go pale and have a lazy eye at will. I mean, yeah. It's shown that he also is a witch, so
So yeah, he's using his powers in the best way possible.
So I think we should maybe talk a bit about some of the magic that happens before that point.
Yeah, well, the magic is quite oddly defined, right? I mean, it might just be that, you know, I haven't read lots of fantasy, admittedly. So my main experience with magic, I guess as a kid, would have been reading the Discworld books. But then after that, having read a certain amount of Ursula Le Guin, and Ursula Le Guin is pretty thorough with her magic ontologies. That, you know, magic in Ursula Le Guin has quite a kind of solid linguistic base. Whereas it's interesting because a lot of these kids, you know, are only, you know, it's almost like, I guess they're adolescent and it's like going through puberty, perhaps, you know, that they're coming into their realisation that they're witches. Right. And so there's a lot of sort of trying magic on the fly. Right, you know, that they'll say, oh, abracadabra, hocus pocus, make this town swarm with locusts.
Yeah.
And then look at their witches, it works.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed I feel like it's sort of because, obviously, they haven't been taught how to use their magic, and any information about magic is so repressed that they just sort of just wave their hands and mutter and say abracadabra and make out little rhymes.
Yeah, they have to wing it.
Yeah. but it works, which I quite like.
It's a scrappy ad hoc approach to magic, but it's quite different to anything. I mean, as I said, I haven't read the Harry Potter.
No, really.
It's the only thing that's interesting about me. Don't take it away from me. But my impression from the little I do know and the film I watched is that magic is a bit more systematised, right, in the Harry Potter universe.
Yeah, I mean, their magic is like in the first Harry Potter book when Harry meets Ron on the train and Ron's like, Oh, I've got told this spell. And he says, sunshine, daisies, butter, mellow, turn this stupid fat rat yellow. And obviously it doesn't do anything because that's not how magic works in Harry Potter.
Ah, okay.
But that's how magic works in this book.
Yeah.
So in the first magic that happens is the birds appearing in their music lesson. Because they... all the songs seem to be about birds. And then all these birds start streaming through the windows, including, like, I don't know, like an albatross.
And a parrot
that shouts cuckoo. but that's, I think, the more outlandish birds are disappeared, and then...
Well, I've got lots of birds on my cover, so what cover do you have?
Oh, okay. I have... So it's Nan on a broomstick. She's, like, wearing the sort of pink blanket as a cape and flying above the school and this field surrounding it, and below her there's what is presumably Mr. Wentworth on a flying carpet.
Yes, that would be... Mr. Wentworth, yeah. Yes.
He doesn't look old enough.
Okay.
But he's shaking his fist at Nan above him. And then she, and she's waving. Yeah, it's very much that pose.
Okay. I've got Crestomancy striding towards the school in the distance. And then he's surrounded by lots of different exotic birds. So there's a stork and a parrot and an owl and a flamingo and a toucan, which is my favourite.
Oh, yeah. Good.
And it says underneath, no magic allowed here.
Oh, yes. quite right.
So then there's the magic with the shoes.
Yes. So... Charles has The bully character, Dan Smith, has hidden Charles's running shoes.
Yeah, I know that kind of jape too well.
So Charles tries to find his shoes by magic, but instead of doing that, he summons all the shoes in the school, into an enormous pile. I think it's because he's panicking and he can't work the magic properly. So,
yeah, there's some idea that if witches are scared, that their magic goes wrong.
So there's this vast pile of shoes, and they have to spend the morning laying out all these shoes in the quadrangle so that people can come and select the ones that are theirs. People are quite determined by this time that it's Nan, and they're like, "Oh, really, Nan? Why did you do this? It's so inconvenient."
Yeah, they all seem decidedly unimpressed. Like, yeah. Come on, look, I know you're a witch, but what's this, shoes? This is rubbish, no.
Yeah. And so Charles is next escapade into magic. Like, he wants to do something better than just create an enormous pile of shoes. So he decides to put a spell on Simon, who's the sort of perfect boy. That means that everything he says will come true. And at first this seems like it's totally backfired, as Simon's just creating a massive pile of gold coins for himself. but then it sort of goes kind of awry, it starts causing chaos by what does he do? He tells some of the girls that they stink, and then they're all
stink.
They all stink.
And he says something like, "I haven't got a thought in my head," or something along those lines, and manages to then make it so he doesn't have a thought in his head, but then he also ends up being kind of sneaky. Do you have illustrations in your coffee?
No, I don't.
The drawing of him looking kind of empty-headed but sneaky is really funny. It's a ridiculous drawing. It's really funny.
Oh, you should put that up.
I think I might have to scan this one in. It's a pretty good illustration.
Nirupa manages to... he thinks he breaks the spell by getting Simon to say something like, "Oh, none of what I'm saying comes true," or "Nothing I say will come true." And later it turns out that he didn't break it, he just reversed it, so that now, anything that Simon says will not come true. And I'm not quite sure at what point in this chronology, but one of the most memorable scenes is that Charles decides to give himself a painful reminder to not do witchcraft. I think he's brought to Mr. Wentworth and sort of told, like, if you keep doing this, you know, an inquisitor will find you and you will be burned.
So
Charles decides that he is going to impress this upon himself, that it hurts to be burnt.
Do you have this bit to read?
Oh yeah, okay. So this is, Charles has borrowed a candle, and he's put his finger in it, and for a second he thought the flame was not going to burn him. It just felt warm and wet. Then quite suddenly it was hot, and it hurt very much indeed. It hurt, as Charles had expected, in quite a different way from cutting yourself or stubbing your toe. This was a much nastier pain, sharp and dull together, which brought Charles's back out in goose pimples and jangled the nerves all the way up his arm. "Imagine this all over you," he thought. "It hurts to be burnt." He took hold of his wrist with his other hand and held it hard to stop himself snatching his finger out of the pain. It hurts to be burnt. It did hurt, too. It was making sweat brickle out just beneath his eyes. It must be for a dare or a bet, he heard Simon saying. Which is it? Tell, or I'll put the candle away again. A bet, Charles answered at random. It hurts to be burnt. It hurts to be burnt. He thought this over and over, intent on branding it into his brain, or into whatever part of him that it was that did magic. It hurts to be... Oh, it hurts. It hurts to be burnt. Some people, Simon remarked, make awfully stupid bets. Charles ignored him and tried to keep his jerking finger steady. It was trying to jump out of the flame with its own accord. The finger was now red, with a white band across the red. He could hear a funny noise, a sort of tiny frizzling, as if his skin was frying. Then suddenly he could bear no more. He found himself snatching his finger away and blowing out the candle. The boys watching him all let out a sigh, as if they had been holding their breath.
Pretty dark for a kid's book.
Yeah, so that was definitely a bit that stuck with me.
I think some of the horror is also the fact that he's in such a desperate state that he's able to physically force himself to do this.
Yeah. I don't know, it's sort of just imagining that, because, you know, no one knows if you've ever actually burnt yourself on something, you know, you reflexively pull your hand away.
Like. Yeah, absolutely. Like if you burn yourself on the hob or whatever, yeah, you just instinctually just say, yeah, no, I found that bit quite powerful. I like the way that the kids, at first they're finding it funny, and then by the end of it, obviously they're quite disturbed by it and, you know, are holding their breath, presumably in this sort of bewildered, grim fascination.
Yeah.
I like the way that it reflects the way that sometimes that can happen as kids, you know, someone can do something that starts as a jape and then, you know, ends off going too far or becoming disturbing. I say my best friend Peter was somewhat the master of this kind of thing. Basically, like, I remember him gashing his leg open, I think in sixth form, while trying to scale some kind of fence, and came back into the class and, you know, had blood just streaming down his leg. And people were like, oh my gosh, Peter, you're bleeding. And he, you know, of course, ended up applying the blood to his face, marking his face in blood. And then scooping up the blood with mini cheddars and gobbling it down.
Yeah.
I'm sure with some enthusiasm from myself, I will admit. Peter was very good at excelling himself in in outlandish and somewhat scary behaviour. Bless him.
Yeah. And then it also gets fairly dark with Nan, as the other girls, also the group of popular girls, corner her in the bathroom and demand that she rides a broomstick, as she's a witch. Threaten to drown her.
Yeah.
They threateningly running the bath and say, oh, witches don't drown, you know, we could put you underwater and you wouldn't drown. This only gets stopped because this is when the Simon Says spell kicks in, so they all run away to see what Simon's doing. But yeah, it's pretty threatening.
I never had my head put down the toilet as a kid, but having OCD, it was a pretty present worry that this would happen at some point. You know, I'd heard of it happening in the school. The idea of being sort of waterboarded, basically, in a toilet, was genuinely something that scared me quite a lot as a kid.
It turns out that Nan can ride the broomstick, although not very well. It sort of drags her up to the ceiling.
No, it's not her fault. The broomstick's a jerk.
Yeah, no, it is.
And I like the fact that the book, Diana Wynne Jones, points out that riding a broomstick would be really uncomfortable, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's lots of descriptions of it. Sort of having to wrap your limbs around this ridiculous, knobbly...
hard stick.
Yeah. And how impractical that is.
Yeah, yeah.
So she only gets the broom to put her down by promising it that she'll take it out later on.
But the broom is a double-crossing broom.
It is, because it turns out that it's actually Brian Wentworth's broom. Because when Nan takes it out, she's all wrapped up in blankets, and she meets Mr. Wentworth riding... the flying carpet. I don't think he shakes his fist at her as illustrated on this cover, but he thinks that she's Brian, and says, oh, can't you control that thing yet? And I told you not to take it out during term time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it turns out that Mr. Wentworth is also a witch.
So as you said, Nan and is it Estelle?
Yeah.
Sort of summon Christomancy.
Yes. So they go to... they escape from the store... Because after Brian disappears and blames it on a witch, an inquisitor is going to come to the school. So Charles and Nirupam and Nan and Estelle separately escape. Nan and Estelle go to... this old building that Estelle knows about to try and find the witch's underground. And it turns out that it's just one old woman who... sort of the organisation's been disbanded by the Inquisitors, and she's only allowed to stay there because she's so elderly. And is constantly being monitored, so all she can do is give them this spell that's been passed down to her. Which is just to go to a certain place in the woods and to say the word Christomancy 3 times. So Nan and Estelle are going to the woods, and separately Charles and Nirupam are flying to also towards the woods on a mop and a hoe as the broom is otherwise engaged, so which is quite a funny sequence.
Yeah,
it seems like all the implements that could be used for flying have different personalities. And so it ends up they find Brian in the woods, and he's very annoyed to be found by them. And the 5 of them are there when Christomancy is summoned. And
I guess for most readers, it's like, hey, it's Christomancy. I was waiting for him. And for us, kid and me now, we're like, oh, hey, it's Christomancy.
It's Christomancy, yes. Oh, yeah. So he is quite bewildered to find himself... where he is.
As bewildered as the reader is.
As bewildered as the reader, if you haven't read any of the other books. Sort of his... The quest from this sort of the last quarter of the book is Christomancy trying to find out what has gone wrong with this world. For it to exist, that it's sort of like... 20th century, late 20th century Britain, but there's still witches being burnt. And he's... So the world in the world of Christomancy is there are about series of worlds, and different books are set in different versions of these worlds, some of which have magic, some of which don't. And sort of the people who are able to go between them. And that basically Crestomancy feels that this world is a kind of offshoot of our one that should never have happened. But because talking about witchcraft is so strongly forbidden, it's really hard for him to find out exactly what has gone wrong. So he essentially makes the kids invisible and takes them back to the school and sort of sets up he pretends to be the Inquisitor and sort of sets up an Inquisitor's room to talk to all the kids on the pretense of, you know, trying to find out if they're a witch or not, but actually trying to get clues as to what's happened to this world.
Well, did you want to say how the book ends?
Yeah, so the book ends with basically there's the kind of reveal that everyone's a witch. Nearly everyone is a witch. And we eventually figure out that that what has gone wrong is to do with Guy Fawkes. And in this world, Guy Fawkes blew up the Houses of Parliament. And when he did that, it was at the end of the Witch Week. And this kind of blew all this magic out into the world. So witchcraft's incredibly common, but also incredibly feared. So we come back to the Simon Says spell, and sort of Nan's using her gift of description to describe exactly what happened with Guy Fawkes, and the class kind of all use their magic together. And then they get Simon to say that Guy Fawkes blew up the Houses of Parliament. Which means that it didn't happen. And the world is sort of folded back into the world that it should have been. and it ends with this kind of alternative view of these characters sort of in a sort of ordinary school where it seems a lot less grim an echo of the beginning of the book. The teacher finds a note that says someone in this class is a witch, but this time all the class think this is wonderful and they're like, oh, I'm a witch, it's me. And that's how it ends.
So texture of the week.
I have two. One of them's horrible, though.
Oh, that's all right. That's fine.
Yeah.
Textures can be horrible.
Yeah. So I briefly mentioned there. Do you want to go first? Because I've been talking a bunch.
Although I'm concerned, maybe it'd be the same. Because I was thinking Charles's blistered finger.
Oh no, that wasn't mine. But yeah.
Oh, that I mean, my sister, and she's fine now, but last year, I think, or the year before, burnt, she accidentally dropped some boiling water on her foot, and her foot really, really blistered up, and some of the toes were like, you know, sort of three times their normal size, and she let me feel them, and they felt like smooth plastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was so strange. It was really hard to connect it to the sensation of skin because it was so kind of uniform and kind of textureless.
Yeah.
So I guess because of that, I had quite a clear sense of Charles's blistered finger. And also the knobbly broom, I suppose, when they're having to ride the brooms.
Yeah. So, no, I got two different, totally different ones.
Okay.
So one of them was, it turns out that Charles's missing shoes were the bully had hidden them under the floorboards where they hide their midnight snacks, and Nirupam found them and turned them into a cake so that the bully Dan would eat them. So he says, the spikes were turned into cherries, the soles were the cream, the shoes as a whole became what is called a Black Forest gatto. just imagining this pair of shoes turned into a cake.
It's quite a Jan Schrankmeyer-like image.
So. Yeah. and then my other one is from the scene that we haven't mentioned yet, but is also pretty memorable, is where Nan, Charles, and Nirupam are called to the high table to have dinner with the headmistress.
Oh yes, right near the beginning of the book.
Yeah, and Nan gets this compulsion to describe the food in the most horrible way possible. Just sort of narrate the food, so. She's describing, now these things, Nan continued, stabbing her fork into a tin tomato, are small creatures that have been killed and cleverly skinned. Notice when you taste them, the slight sweet savour of their blood. Yeah. Definitely. It's a gift for memorably horrible description.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find it scary?
I didn't find it scary. I found it unsettling and disturbing.
I think it's legitimately horrifying in a quiet way. Like, it's more of a fantasy novel than a horror novel, obviously. Mm. But it definitely has a kind of dark and gloomy atmosphere to it.
Mm. Yeah, I think you can definitely feel sort of the oppressive weight of this world and the constant threat of, you know, the Inquisitors and and it's horrifying, the idea that people are regularly burnt alive, and that's just something that's accepted.
And on that note,
there's one more thing I liked, which was that magic is actually quite a good replacement swear word.
Oh, it is actually. I thought that too, on magicking.
Magicking was... hell. Yeah. Yeah. It's got that good K sound to it.
Yeah, maybe, you know, we're obviously, we try to be a pretty universal, you know, we're on iTunes, where you can review us. We're down as being like suitable for all, I think.
Yes.
So we don't generally swear, but if we do feel the need, we could say magicking in
future. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's quite good.
Right, do you want to do the credits?
So you can find us on Twitter at stillscaredpod, email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music's by Jay Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson, and I'll put all the links in the show notes, where there will also be a transcript. Do you have a sign off, Adam?
Yeah, have a magicking good week.
Yeah. Have a magicking good week, speaker kids. See you next time.